Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program about the economic dimensions of our lives, jobs, incomes, debts, you know, all of that financial stuff. I'm your host, Richard Wolff, been a professor of economics all my adult life, and now devoted to these radio programs as well as speaking across the country. Currently, I teach at the New School University in New York City. As usual, we will open our program with a series of short updates, and I want to begin this week by catching you up on a small issue, but maybe not so small for the folks involved, from a couple of weeks ago. It has to do with the Driscoll Berry Company. You know, the company that produces a wide variety of berries, attractively packaged in plastic, that you can buy on the street and in the store. Driscoll Berries turns out to be part of a larger corporation that employs huge numbers of workers in Mexico to produce those berries. Backbreaking labor, for which the pay in Mexico is about $8 a day. And the workers there are on strike, and I noted that, because they want $13 a day. They want to go from dire poverty to less dire poverty. And, of course, as a profit-making capitalist enterprise, Driscoll Berries doesn't want to make that increase in payment lest it damage their profits. There it is, the most basic struggle of a capitalist economic system, and something I don't want you to be unaware of the next time you consider buying berries. The strike has been going on for months. I checked this last week in order to let you know that indeed it continues. The next update has to do with a blockbuster event in the world of big business last week, the purchase by the Verizon Telephone Company of AOL, America Online, a company that's been around and been in and out of mergers with other companies as well. And I wanted to talk about one feature that didn't get quite the publicity it might have. Part of the reason for that merger was the enthusiastic support of the chief economic officer, the CEO of AOL, a man by the name of Tim Armstrong. I wanted to let you know, because I know you'd be pleased for him, that he is going to get $180 million as part of this deal, as well, on top of that, of a long-term contract with his new partner, his new merged Verizon boss. We do not know what the terms of that long-term contract might be, but getting $180 million at the get-go for all of this certainly suggests that Tim will be in good shape for the rest of his life, even if lots of workers at AOL and workers at Verizon and in the towns where they are active might have to begin to worry about what else is going to happen at the company and what that might mean for their jobs. And that's in the end what I want to stress. The people who made this decision, the merger of Verizon and AOL, are a tiny number of people. Major shareholders, maybe a bank or two that's got big loans out to them, and the chief economic officers, two, three, four people in each of the two corporations. How many people do they employ? Tens of thousands. So here we go, folks, the wonderful democracy of a capitalist system. A handful of people, 10, 20, at the outside, made a decision to affect the futures, the incomes, the jobs, the security of tens of thousands of employees, and not to speak of the communities, the cities and towns in which they live and to which Verizon or AOL paid taxes, may or may not pay taxes in the future, depending on what the same tiny number of people decide next week and next month. Democracy means that all the folks affected by a decision participate in it. All the tens or maybe even hundreds of thousands of people affected by the Verizon AOL merger did not participate in that decision. It is not a democratic decision. Those decisions never are. The people who made the decision have paid themselves very well in the bargain. And for the rest, worry. Next item from last week. Facebook Corporation, you're all familiar with that, announced with great self-congratulations that it would henceforth insist that companies it signs contracts with would have to show them that they were paying at least $15 an hour, offered their workers at least 15 days off paid per year, and provided either parental leave or some sort of financial help for new parents. Like the Microsoft Corporation, which did something similar a little bit earlier, these corporations proudly announce that they're doing something for inequality. Well, it turns out that this is more hype than reality, don't you know? Let me explain. A comparison between what these companies are doing and a recent contract won by the drivers of the buses that take the workers to and from Facebook headquarters shows that when those drivers unionized and bargained with the company, they got a much larger increase than this company gave on its own to its non-unionized workers. Hello. It turns out that if workers organize themselves, they do better than waiting for whatever handout the corporate executives choose to offer. And of course, here again is that democracy problem. If the goal is to reduce inequality and to finally make corporations pay decent salaries and wages, then that oughtn't to be left to the goodwill or lack thereof of the corporate executives, should it? They are the minority, and the mass of people whose life conditions they're determining are the majority, aren't they? So you'd want to have it at least be the law that these things have to be done. Because, of course, what a corporate executive can give to his or her workers today is something that that corporate executive can take away from workers on another day. And that is happening to so many millions of workers in America in the last 5 years that this hypothetical is terribly real. But what's the best solution? The best solution is not to leave it to the whim of executive minorities. And it's not even to leave it to a union, and it's not even to leave it to the law. In the end, the way you make sure that working conditions are good for the majority who are workers is to put the workers in charge of the enterprises, to convert them into the worker self-directed co-ops we talk about, because that, in the end, is the democratic and the secure way to do what Facebook would like us to applaud if and when they feel like doing it, if and when they feel like enforcing the rule, and if and when a change of leadership at Facebook doesn't decide to do something else. Next update. I want to celebrate with Yale University. They got a big contribution last week, $150 million, from a venture capitalist, a private equity, a famous fellow named Schwartzman, who went to Yale years ago. I'm not interested in the details. I'm just interested in the economics of this. Schwartzman is a billionaire. So here's what we got. A billionaire takes a small part of his wealth, $150 million for a multi-billionaire is not a lot, and gives it to the second richest university in the United States. So we've got a billionaire donor giving some of his money to a billionaire university. Yale's endowment is upwards of $25 billion. So one billionaire is enriching another billionaire. If I were a charitable giver, like Mr. Schwartzman wants us to believe he is, I might have been able to come up with something more deserving. Can you imagine? More deserving than giving an already multi-billion dollar university another $150 million, which, by the way, they're going to use to enhance their fine arts activities, which are already among, according to them, the best in the world. They're going to get better still. That we're not helping starving people. We're not helping a crippled public education system. We're not helping a crippled transportation system. We're not helping the problem of poverty. No. We're making a billion-dollar university richer still. Is that the end of the economics? No. Because when Mr. Schwartzman gives $150 million away, that charitable contribution can be and will be used by his accountants to lower his taxable income. That is, charitable donations to universities, no matter how rich they are, and no matter how rich the donor, are tax deductible. Mr. Schwartzman will save, ready, upwards of $75 million that he would have had to pay Uncle Sam during 2015. He won't have to pay those $75 million because his taxability, his tax liability is reduced because he gave Yale $150 million, which means the federal government will have much less money to serve the American people. A billionaire gives a small amount of his money to a billion-dollar university, and all the rest of us have a harder time getting services from the government. Does that sound like a reasonable system, or does that sound like a system in which those who have rich wealth at the top organize it to become richer still? Where's the democracy in capitalism? Please. Next item. Last week was an election in the UK, in the United Kingdom. And a number of you have emailed me asking me to comment about it. I shall. We know that the democracy, and that really should be put in quotes, shouldn't it? That the democracy of the United States politically is a very questionable reality, if it's a reality at all. And so it is in our friendly neighbor, the United Kingdom. Here's how things went last week. The Conservatives won, led by David Cameron. They now have an absolute majority in the British Parliament. How did they achieve the absolute majority of seats in the Parliament? By getting 37% of the vote. That's right. Almost two-thirds of the voters in the United Kingdom preferred somebody else to the person who's actually going to run their government. Landslide? Yeah, the landslide was for people who didn't like him. But that's how it works in the United Kingdom. 5% or so of the people in Scotland are so untrustworthy of the United Kingdom as a whole proposition that they made the biggest upset by sending 56 people to the parliament. That's right, 5% of the voters sent 56 members of parliament representing the Scottish National Party. Now things get even weirder. The United Kingdom Independence Party, an anti-immigration right-wing party, got 13% of the vote. That's right, more than twice the vote gotten by the Scottish National Party. But where the Scottish National Party got 56 seats, the UKIP got one seat for its 13%. If this is peculiar math, that's the problem of how economics and politics get together in countries where a tiny minority need to stay and control power. What's the real bottom line here? Conservatives, gathering more and more of the wealth of their societies into fewer and fewer hands, know they have a big problem. How to hold on to their wealth when they are depriving the majority of their fellow citizens of any of it. They have to control politics. That's harder and harder to do. They have to gerrymander the rules. They have to control by making it so expensive to run for office that you push out more and more of the people likely to be critical of an unfair distribution of wealth. And we're going to come back to that again in a few minutes. So here's what they do. The people in charge begin to appeal to the population by hoping to get a chunk of the votes by promising certain parts of the population, economic times are hard, but we'll protect you. You vote for us, and we'll protect you, and we'll make the pain fall on somebody else. So the conservatives in England are going to make the pain fall on the moochers, the folks who are poor, the folks who don't have jobs, the folks who you can portray as being blameworthy rather than blaming an economic system that can't find work for millions of people who want it. That's right. You split the population and you appeal to part of it to vote for you so you continue to do the damage to the other part. We should see that as Mr. Cameron's quote-unquote secret. He knew how to go after the right part of the English population, and the Scottish people didn't miss the message either. They don't trust the Conservatives, and they showed it. They're afraid of being the scapegoat in this economic game of Russian roulette. And we should recognize it here in the United States because it's the same strategy that conservatives here use. Governor Walker in Wisconsin, for example, made an example for all of us by savaging public employees, basically saying to the people of Wisconsin, the private sector workers, vote for me. Because in these hard times when we're whacking everybody with austerity, we'll whack you private employees less and we'll take it out on the public employees. So he wrote them off, appealed to the privates by scapegoating the public, splitting the working class in order to get away with a program that impoverishes the whole class by setting them against each other. Congratulations to the conservatives. What a constructive way to play politics. Last short update. Tragic news from the Mediterranean. Boatloads of immigrants desperately trying to get across the Mediterranean Sea from North Africa to Europe, having to spend their last nickel, for a rickety ride in a dangerous boat. And once again, because this has become a regular occurrence, the boat capsizes and hundreds, sometimes thousands of people die with their bodies washing up on the beaches of the Riviera, or threatening to. What is this about? Well, this is a program in economics, so let's get right to the economic root of this problem. It isn't unscrupulous boat operators, although of course they're there. And it isn't unwise decisions of immigrants of which boat to take. How should they know? Here's the economics. If you have an economic system in the world that polarizes the world into areas that are very comfortable, very well off, and very rich relative to other parts that are very poor, very uncomfortable, very precarious, can you be surprised that people at the desperate end of the part of the world that is neglected by modern capitalism want to leave that part of the world and move to where circumstances, conditions, jobs, incomes are better? If you don't want horrible deaths of poor people trying to get to a better life, then don't let there be a system that gives them every reason, as we have seen, to do what these tragedies report. I want to turn next, as we do at this time in each program, to responding to some of your questions. First question comes from a listener in the Midwest of the United States, and she asks, what is the latest information about the feelings Americans have for the distribution of wealth and income in the United States? So to answer this question, I went to the most recent Gallup poll, released, as it happens, last week. And the Gallup poll is very interesting. It asks two questions, and it has been asking them every few years since 1984. So we have about 30 years of responses. And here's something very interesting. The first question is, do you think, random Americans were asked, do you think that the distribution of wealth and income in the United States is fair or unfair? Explain. 63% in the latest poll of Americans believe that the distribution of wealth and income is unfair and tilts in favor of the rich. Even more interesting is that that number hasn't changed much in 30 years. That's right, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, 10 years ago, it's pretty much 62, 64, 66. A little less than two-thirds of the American people agree that the distribution of wealth and income in America is unfair and favors the rich. Here comes the second question. Would you be supportive, this question asks, of using heavy taxation on the rich to fix this problem of inequality? In the latest poll, 52% of Americans favor heavy taxation of the rich. 30 years ago, it was only 40%. That has been steadily rising over 30 years, so now a clear majority favor that. So that's the simple answer to your question. But now let's see what it means. First, for 30 years, a majority of people in America have felt that the distribution of income and wealth was unfair and tilted to the rich. Yet at the same time, across those 30 years, the Congress and the President of the United States, representing both major parties, Republican and Democrat, took step after step to make the distribution of wealth and income more unequal than it already was. In other words, and this is the clearest proof you could ask for, what the political establishment of both parties achieved was the diametric opposite of what the clear majority of the American people wanted and expressed explicitly. The government of the United States, there is no other conclusion, does not reflect, does not respect, and does not address what the majority of the people want. It made the rich minority richer in direct contradiction to what the mass of the people want. It has not only taxed wealthy people less than before, but it has done so and produced in the mass of the people a rising anger about it. We do not live in a representative democracy, because whoever that government represents, it isn't the majority of the people. Finally, a simple question, which we have some time for. Is it the case that Social Security benefits can be withheld by the government if you are a student with outstanding debts? And the answer is subject to a variety of special conditions and exemptions. The basic answer is yes. If you don't pay your student debt, the government can and the government has withheld, reduced your benefits under Social Security. Is this outrageous? Yes, of course it is. It means that when you're in such difficulty that you can't repay your debt, the federal government is going to add to your difficulty by withholding Social Security benefits to which you have proven yourself eligible. But the deeper problem here is obvious. I have talked about it before, but I want to make sure you understand my position, and I believe it's a reasonable one. In almost all advanced industrial countries other than the United States, it is well understood that an educated population, a population which is supported and encouraged to get as much education as they can usefully absorb, that that's a national asset. That makes a society work better. It produces happier, more fulfilled people. It raises everybody's productivity. It is a national treasure. And therefore, those societies subsidize higher education. They make it a government service, much as we do in the United States with public school from kindergarten through senior high school. For some reason in the United States, we don't do that above high school, whereas most other countries do. And we tell people that we won't give you a job if you don't have a degree. So, of course, they have to go get one. And we are charging them more and more money because the government won't subsidize public higher education the way it once did, forcing people into terrible debt. That's the root problem here. We could and we should tax those most able to pay, corporations and the rich, to provide the higher and the lower free education that a modern, cultivated, civilized society, especially one that's rich like us, could and should afford. It is a travesty of democracy, but even of common sense, to burden a whole generation, and for the first time in America, with enormous debts. Well, we've come to the end of the first half of this program. I want to ask you, please, to stay with us. A very interesting second half is coming with some major topics you've asked me to talk about, getting some extensive analysis. This is Richard Wolff, and as I said, please stay with us. We will be right back. Welcome, friends, to the second half of today's Economic Update. Once again, I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I bring you this show every week. And during this second half, we address two or three major issues, usually issues that a number of you have raised questions about. And I want to ask you and to thank you for your partnership in this program. We really value the emails we get, the suggestions you make, sometimes the documents and materials you send us. These are very valuable ways for us to understand what you would like us to analyze, what economic questions and issues to address, and so on. Partnership also entails your making use of our websites, rdwolf2fs.com and democracyatwork.info. Both of these websites offer you all the materials, and we update them every single day, all the materials that we collect, that we work on, that allows you to get much more than even this program can provide. In addition, the websites allow you to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. They allow you to communicate directly with us through emails. And finally, they are a way for you to share as you can on social media yourself what we do here, and we ask you to do it. We ask you to let other people know about this program, to invite them to listen to this program and to communicate with us about it, to share any particular insights you may have gained. This is a way to make our work more effective and a way to make us more useful to more people, and we would be grateful if you were to do that. I'll have a few words more to say about that at the end of the program. Okay. Let's jump in. I want to spend a little time talking about two topics that you might not in your mind put together, but that really are very well linked. One is the problem of unemployment, a perennial difficulty of capitalist economic systems, and ecology, environment, the question of respecting and preserving and nurturing our dependence as human beings on the natural environment, which gives us life. So let's start with the unemployment, and then I'll show you its link to ecology. The way modern capitalist societies generally handle unemployment is the height of unfairness and irrationality. Let me explain. In general, when unemployment, mass unemployment, it descends on a capitalist economy, which is every few years in what those folks who like capitalist economies tend to refer as recessions, downturns, and people who are less befuddled, hard times, and people who are still less befuddled, crises. Well, whatever you call it, mass unemployment periodically descends, usually on millions of people, more or less, at the same time. For example, in 2008, it descended across the world, practically, and we were talking then about hundreds of millions of people thrown out of work. Clearly, in those situations, it isn't the fault of the unemployed. They didn't suddenly become, you know, lax. They didn't suddenly lose their skills. They didn't suddenly become less productive. Rather, they were caught up in an economic system that had no use for them. Now, the proper way to handle a social problem like that, you might call it an economic tsunami sweeping across modern capitalism, would be to share the pain. Because it's no one particular group that you can blame for the unemployment, even though Lord knows there are folks who try. It is really a social phenomena of a capitalist system. So the proper way to handle this crisis would be for everybody to share the pain. We'll get through this together, you know, teamwork and all that. And how would that work? Simple. You don't take one part of the population and plunge them into the disaster of having no work and no income. If you need, for example, at the height of the 2008-2009 unemployment here in the United States, we had in excess of 10% of our people unemployed. Okay, sharing would mean that instead of saying to 10% of the people, your life is now a disaster. You have no job, you have no income, you have all the problems that go with it. And saying to the other 90%, it's not your problem. We could instead say everybody works 10% less than they did before. That means we share the unemployment. Instead of firing some people, we reduce the work week for everybody. Then everybody would share. Let's go back. Why don't we blame a particular group? Well, let's see. Let's see where we would go if we did that. Okay, let's start. Who causes unemployment? Well, the logical answer is whoever tells another person that they won't be paid anymore and their services are not wanted. In other words, employers cause unemployment by firing people. That's what happened in 2008. Tens of thousands of employers told hundreds of millions of workers not to come back to work because they weren't wanted and they wouldn't be paid. So if you're looking for the group that caused unemployment, the first place for you to look would be the private employers and then also the public employers who laid workers off, who fired them. But of course, a sophisticated economic analysis would then ask the question, why did those employers relatively suddenly fire all these people? Why did they cause unemployment? And I would be the first to show that it's because their profits were either falling or threatened, or in some way their economic viability as enterprises was in trouble, and they resolved that problem, or they tried to get out of their dilemma by laying off workers, because then they wouldn't have to pay them, which after all wouldn't make much sense if they were having trouble selling what they paid those workers to produce. So I understand it isn't really the fault of those who fired a lot of workers. It's really a system problem. The employer was caught up in a system that made him do something that caused millions more people to lose their jobs. Well, if it isn't the fault of the employer who fired you, and it is the fault of the system, then why is the burden of unemployment put only on some people rather than being shared? If the employers have to share the pain in the lowered profits, lowered business, poorer conditions they all face, then workers ought to be able to share the pain too. And that would mean reducing the work week for all workers for as long as the economic downturn lasts. Why isn't this done, this fairer, more equitable, more democratic way of handling the unemployment flaw of capitalism as it recurringently visits this disaster on us? Because the answer is here, I think, a political one. If all workers were periodically told, well, Frank, well, Mary, you're going on 90% time rather than 100%, we're only going to pay you 9/10 of your salary because you're only going to be working 9/10 the hours because everybody's sharing the 10% unemployment, guess what would happen? All of the workers being affected by unemployment would all become much more interested and much more critical of an economic system that dumps this unemployment problem on them periodically and recurringly. That would be dangerous for capitalism. It's much easier to sustain a capitalist system if you keep singling out a small or hopefully not too large section of the population and really dump unemployment on them and exempt others from it. It's a little bit like the strategy of Mr. Cameron in England for his election and Mr. Walker in Wisconsin for his, isn't it? It's a kind of scapegoat economics. Even better if you can make it the same people who get dumped into unemployment first. You know, the last ones hired and the first ones fired, those folks. And if they're different from others, ethnically, skin color, gender, doesn't really matter, then you can begin to suggest to the 90% who have no unemployment that it really isn't about a system that can't provide work, it's a flaw in those people. And then you have unemployment rationalized by something well on its way to racism. Let's go back to this idea of sharing unemployment. Because now I can draw the bridge between an analysis of unemployment on the one hand and the ecology or environmental considerations on the other. Let's suppose we had a rational society that decided not only what it wanted to have produced, goods and services, housing, food, clothing, transportation, entertainment, whatever, but also took ecological, environmental considerations seriously. Not to further damage the ozone layer, not to further contribute to global warming, not to damage the earth, the water, the air, all of that that you all know very well. Then it might be decided, democratically, one hopes, to put to the mass of people the question, can we find ways to be more respectful, to be better able to preserve the natural environment we depend on than we have been, and what are the implications for work? And such a deliberation could decide, yes, we can get by very well with much less stuff, and that will preserve our energy resources, it will preserve the health and well-being of our natural environment. And it has another benefit. If we produce less and use up less of our earth, we will also therefore have to work less. And this would become appealing to the American people if they knew that the benefit of ecological consciousness would include sharing more leisure. Let me explain very concretely. In the United States, and indeed in many parts of the world that are copying the United States, we move people around by means of private automobiles to an extraordinary extent. And private automobiles are notorious for the deaths and injuries they cause in traffic accidents, for the enormous waste of energy that is involved in moving one person in one vehicle as opposed to 20, 30, or 40 people in a bus or a train, etc. The pollution caused by the private automobile far exceeds what public transportation would provide. So let's see. Were we to decide to save on the energy waste and the pollution and the death and injury that the private automobile mode of transportation entails, and if we were to move instead to beautiful, well-prepared, high-quality, frequent public transportation in all the urban and suburban areas where most people in most advanced countries now live, we would be able to give everybody several hours a week less work. We wouldn't be making those cars anymore because we wouldn't need them. We would be making, and it takes many fewer hours, it would be making trains and buses and vans instead. And if that, here we go now, if that cut in the production of automobiles was accomplished by sharing the benefit that we don't need to spend umpteen million hours producing the cars we no longer rely on, if that were shared, then the mass of people would be able, by the same decision, to save on the waste of energy involved in the car, to save on the death and injury involved in a car-based transportation system, to save on the pollution of air and water that wasteful car production has always meant, and at the same time give themselves fewer hours of labor, which would be shared across all industries and not just the automobile. Therefore, everybody would continue to work. They'd have less hours, and you know something? Because of the savings in money from going from a private to a public transportation system, even the fact that the fewer hours you worked meant you got a little bit less pay, it wouldn't impact your standard of living, because if you think about it, you would be saving a fortune moving to high-quality, mass-produced, mass transportation from the enormous expenses of your private car with its private insurance and its private excessive fueling, etc., etc. Our dependence on oil, all of it could be changed. There are other examples. Group housing is much cheaper than individual housing. What about that? And the savings in labor that could be shared by everybody if we understood the wisdom, the ethics, and the democratic appeal of sharing the work, just like we should share the unemployment if it happens. Substituting collective child care for the individual child care we now rely on in this country, at least. Providing subsidized, inexpensive, healthy, publicly provided food for people to pick up on their way home rather than spending time having lots of little producers making lots of little food along the way, duplicating the effort needlessly and inefficiently. The examples are legion. I don't want to get lost in the specifics. I want the big point to be made. In a rational society, here's how the economic system would be planned. Figure out how much stuff we as a society want. Take into account our needs, our desires, our pleasures. Take account of the economic and the ecological environment we're in. Figure out how many hours of work it would take to produce the goods and services that reflect our respect for our individual needs and wants and our collective dependence on nature, and then divide the work equally among all the able-bodied adults so we all participate in doing the work that we all together decided we as a community want. That's a better way. It's a more rational way. What it doesn't allow for is a tiny group of people to make decisions based on their own profits, even if they flaunt the needs and desires of a democratic society. The most egregious example is how I'll end this conversation. Once upon a time, clothing in the United States, for example, was largely made in the United States. The shirt, the pants, the shoes, the socks you wore were produced a few miles from where you purchased them. That means that very little energy was wasted and very little pollution resulted from moving clothing from the producer to the consumer. 50 years ago, American capitalist enterprises involved in the production of clothing made a decision driven by profitability. They decided it was more profitable to move to China or Bangladesh or Mexico or Africa, or in any case, far away in most cases. China is the prime example. They decided that they could make more money because they could pay Chinese workers a small fraction of what they had come to need to pay American workers, that they could find exemptions for all kinds of expenses that they had here, but that they could avoid in China or Bangladesh or Vietnam or Pakistan or wherever. They left because the profit motive of capitalism drove them to do that. So now, as you all know, your pants, your shirts, and most everything you wear comes from places thousands and thousands of miles away. To cover all of that mileage, energy has to be used to fuel the ships, the trucks, the trains, the planes that bring that all to you. And the burning of that energy leads to pollution of the air and the water. Nobody cared about that for decades, as people got sick, as people who didn't need to died. We were all victims, and I'm not just talking about those who lost their jobs in the clothing industry. They suffered too. But everybody suffered, and the environment suffered, because private profit-driven capitalism works that way. My point is simple. To avoid that kind of economic development, profitable for the few, a disaster for the many and for nature itself, we need to change the way we make decisions and what the bases and goals of our decisions are. Sharing unemployment is not only something we should do as we cope with the irrational instability of capitalism. It's also a way to understand how we can win the majority of our fellow citizens to a program to make ecological preservation a central part of our political future. Because we can go to the people and say, environmental protection is not a threat to your job. Not protecting it is a threat. Going in that direction, finding ways to produce less and to use up less of our natural resources, is also a way to increase leisure as we share, for the first time really, the benefits of a more rational economic system. In the time we have left, which isn't much, I wanted to comment once again on last week's decision by the United States government to prosecute, to hold liable, big banks. This time, five big banks, I'll give you their names in a moment, were hauled up on the carpet for illegally manipulating currency exchange rates. That's right, the rate at which you can exchange a dollar for a euro, or a dollar for a yen, or a British pound for a Swiss franc, or whatever transaction you're interested in. The following five banks manipulated those exchange rates: Barclays, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, Royal Bank of Scotland, and UBS, the Swiss banking giant. The holding companies that are the parents of these banks will now be paying fines in the millions of dollars, possibly even the billions. But they're busily absorbing all of that. Clearly, they don't care much. And they're negotiating with the Justice Department and other agencies waivers. What are those about? That's to allow them to continue to do what they've always been doing, even though they have now admitted to felony violations of the law. This is theater. These prosecutions are what one banker, in a moment of honesty, called a bump in the road. This is a price of doing business. Meanwhile, the too-big-to-fail banks have gotten bigger. We are now seeing that manipulating currencies is damaging. It means, for example, that the imports we rely on priced higher than they might have had to been. That would be a cost to every American, etc., etc. Masses of people affected by what currencies cost, and a tiny group of banks making money by manipulating it in their own interest. By the way, the same banks and others like them, this is now the fifth thing they've been caught out on. They illegally acted during the mortgage crisis. They have been convicted, many of them, or at least admitted to, money laundering, interest rate manipulation, the LIBOR scandal, excessive fee charging. If this were any public enterprise, it would have been called on the carpet, and we would have heard people say, it'd be much better all around if we used private enterprises. I always wonder, how come it doesn't work in reverse? If you have these monster banks clearly holding major responsibility for the economic crisis we're in, clearly now shown to have acted illegally in the mortgage crisis, in money laundering, in interest rate manipulation, in excessive fee charging, and now in currency manipulation, my God, what would they have to do for there finally to be the question, why do we permit private capitalist banks working obviously in their own private profit interest to have the power to make decisions all of us suffer from, and then merely go through this charade of slapping them on the wrist as they giggle forward to do it all again? If an industry has the kinds of social effects we know major large banks do, we've learned that, then they can't be allowed to be made, to have their decisions made by tiny profit-driven shareholders and top executives. That is an irrational as well as undemocratic way to handle your banking system. Well, folks, we've come to the end of our program. I want to remind you of our two websites. Please make use of them. They're available 24/7 at no charge. rdwolf2fs.com and democracyatwork.info. I want to thank truthout.org, that remarkable independent source of news and analysis every day. Do check them out. And finally, I want to remind you about that partnership. I am available to travel around the country as I do, giving talks wherever to people that are interested in bringing me out there. It's a way for me to connect with you, to have one-on-one as well as in-person interactions, to bring this kind of economic analysis to your community. Get in touch with us through the two websites. They are email capable. You can communicate with us if that's of interest. Make use of what we do. Share it on social media. That's why we do it. Thank you very much for your attention, and I look forward to talking with you again next week. Gonna be my time, babe. They ain't gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.